On this week's program, there's thankfully no death, but we do have a lot about taxes. We'll get a full recap from the Texas Scorecard Capital Bureau on all of the developments relating to property tax reform over the last week or so. We'll also talk to Grover Norquist with Americans for Tax Reform on why a tax swap proposal being floated at the Capitol could make matters worse for you as a taxpayer. And we'll close with a commentary from Robert Montoya on how film subsidies aren't just bad for taxpayers, they're bad for filmmakers too. Taxpayers, lend your ears to this week's episode of Texas Scorecard Radio. I'm your host, Tony McDonald, coming to you from the 1836 studios in Austin, Texas. You can find us on the web, www.texasscorecard.com. Articles going up there every day about things that you need to know to be an informed and engaged citizen and taxpayer. Know how to defend your own wallet. To get the show started this week, I've got Brandon Walton's Capital Bureau Chief for Texas Scorecard, and Destin Sinsky, Capital Correspondent there at the Capitol for Texas Scorecard, and wanted to go through and talk a little bit about almost a saga, if you will, that's been going on over the last week or so. Senate Bill 2, the major property tax bill, passing out of the Senate, much to many people's surprise. And I wanted to kind of go through, like, what happened that we've got this bill passing and what people ought to maybe read from that and expect moving forward as we get into the last month and a half here of session. But, Brandon, just for listeners who maybe haven't been following along, what is House Bill 2? There's House Bill 2 and Senate Bill 2.
House Bill 2, Senate Bill 2. When they were first filed, they were identical. And these were pieces of legislation that the governor, lieutenant governor, speaker of the House, everybody sort of rallied around and said, this is the plan for property tax reform in this session.
And essentially, and reform, not relief. This is the reform element. Hey, don't let them go. Don't let taxes climb higher.
Right. And the bill does a number of things. But the big point from the bill is that it sets a voter approval rate, a trigger, if you will, that if a taxing entity, be it a city, county, school district, special purpose district, whatever, if they set a tax rate that goes above, that collects revenue at more than 2.5% increase from the year before, voters get to vote on it. They get to have a say over their skyrocketing
property
taxes.
Super popular. I mean, it's popular with the Republicans, popular with Democrats, not popular with local government officials, of course, who don't want to have to go through this effort. Now, Destin, that bill, the Senate Bill 2, the Senate side version, stalled until last week in the Senate. People are going, okay, they can't get the votes to bring this thing to the floor because you have a liberal senator, Kel Seliger. It's a Republican senator from the Panhandle who's saying, I'm not with the rest of the Republicans on this whole, you know, letting people vote on taxes thing. And so people were looking at House Bill 2 to be the vehicle. It's coming to the floor in the House. Then it kind of goes haywire. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so a game of chicken has been occurring, and everybody's punting on wanting to tackle this issue, the top issue of the session, right? And, you know, all this time has come by. Finally, House Bill 2 is making its way to the floor. And then Texas Scorecard, we broke the story that Governor Abbott last week had quietly been talking with legislators about House Bill 2 being the one that's coming first, not containing the reform mechanisms for school districts.
Yeah, basically, this bill, when it was filed, said, hey, 2.5% trigger for all entities, schools, cities, counties,
right,
special districts. They cut the schools out of the picture when the bill comes out of committee. And, you know, folks know that's like half of your property tax
at least, yeah,
right?
53-54%.
Yeah, it's a huge part of the property tax bill. And so, like, okay, you can't have property tax reform without schools in it. And that's what the governor is apparently saying.
Right. And so he, after we broke the story, came out publicly and said, yes, that's true. I will not sign any property tax reform legislation that does not contain the school districts for that very reason. And so House Bill 2 did not contain the schools at that time, and Senate Bill 2 did.
So when that story breaks, they're supposed to be debating the bill on the House floor that day, and yeah, it's like, oh my gosh.
There's 180 amendments being filed. People are ready for a long day.
Yeah. The story broke literally as they're gaveling in.
Yeah, and it's like,
tackle the
issue. Okay, we've got to take a two-hour lunch break. They come back. Okay, we're delaying. Then they postpone the bill until Monday. All of a sudden, the focus shifts from the House over to the Senate. Tell us a little bit about what started going on over there with Lieutenant Governor Patrick leading on that, Brandon.
Well, you started out in the same position that the Senate has been in for a while, which, as you noted, you have all the Democrats are opposed to this legislation.
Sure.
But specifically, you've also got a liberal Republican state senator out of Amarillo, Kel Seliger, who has put his foot down since the session began and said, I am not going to support this legislation. I don't want to sell out my local officials, apparently not really caring all that much about his taxpaying constituents, but I digress. He's been putting his foot down. He's actually prevented this coming to the floor, and the reason why is because just to give a sort of brief explanation of the Senate rules, bills are taken up in the order that they're passed out of committee, except when they're not, which is about all the time.
Which is all the time, right? Yeah, so the rules, the regular rules say, hey, you're just supposed to take them up in the order that they come out.
Majority of vote, you know, that's how it goes.
Common sense. They don't do that, though. They take, it's a 19-vote, 3/5 threshold.
To bring a bill up out of order.
To bring a bill out of order, which they do for every bill that they pass.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. So
for the last 70 years.
Without Kel Seliger, you had that bill stalled at 18 votes to bring it up to the floor for a debate. Then you saw, right after the House punted on property tax reform, you saw Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick meeting with senators and eventually telling Democrats and telling people opposed, look, this is too important, and we're not going to, you know, essentially threatening to enforce rules that, you know, if we're not going to be able to get the 3/5 vote to do this, then I'm just going to take the bills up in order and we'll vote on them. And it'll, you know, but
yeah, this is like the, towards like the top. Eighth bill in the row. So you just deal with these things. So typically they're sitting on a bill. It's sometimes called the Rosebush bill, it's a blocker bill. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the thing that they're always debating is some bill that they don't want to pass that deals with, you know, parks beautification. And basically Patrick says, well, let's vote on parks beautification.
Yes.
We'll hit this property tax thing eventually. So that's the machinations going on over the weekend. As you get into Monday,
yes,
they Seliger basically folds.
Basically folds. I think realizing that his own negotiation power or whatever he had there was quickly going to disintegrate. I mean, it was very clear Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick had the he was going to do this. A lot of the senators understood that he was going to go forward with this, you know, just simple majority. And Kel Seliger ends up voting, becoming the 19th vote to bring the bill to the floor.
So he agrees for, I guess, protecting his posture with regard to other bills. He wants to be that 19th vote for other bills. Hey, we're not going to let the lieutenant governor start following the rules. We want to continue to do this special
procedure. The age-old tradition.
The age-old
keep
tradition.
It intact.
And so they bring the bill to the floor more or less intact. I think one frustrating element, the 3.5, describe that real quick.
Yeah, so they keep the schools in and at 2.5%, but maybe a concession to Seliger and these local officials is that they raised it to 3.5%. Now, remember, Tony, last session everybody balked at 4% and 5% and 6%. So this is still an improvement from sessions past, obviously, but not the 2.5% a lot of voters were promised at the beginning of session.
Yeah, so next steps, this bill's now out of the Senate, headed over to the House, and it'll be taken up there. We'll see what they do with it there in the House side.
Yes, the ball's in the House's court right now.
Texas Scorecard Radio is a project of Empower Texans. At texasscorecard.com or empowertexans.com, you can find more news and daily updates from all around the Lone Star State. You can also find updates from Empower Texans and Texas Scorecard on Facebook and Twitter, and follow Empower Texans on Instagram. Texas Scorecard's News Digest goes out weekly via email and monthly in print. Subscribe online and find more information at empowertexans.com. Someone's always keeping score. We think it ought to be the taxpayers.
Well, it's my pleasure to welcome on the program this week Grover Norquist with Americans for Tax Reform. Thanks for joining us, sir.
Good to be with you.
So you guys put out a statement about a tax proposal. We'll go into a little bit of detail about that. But you guys put out a statement recently saying, you know, hey, why is Texas you know, this Republican bastion. We always want to put ourselves out there as we're the leaders of conservatism in the nation and therefore the world. Why are you guys increasing taxes? I mean, what's going on?
The oldest trick in the book in the United States is to have all the local politicians and government workers and unions come and say, here's our problem. We can't raise the property tax because people have really had it with the property tax. So could we get the state government to raise its income tax? Texas doesn't have one of those, thankfully, or sales tax in order to keep property taxes down. What that means is that the state will give money to the local government. So it's not really about keeping taxes down. It's about shifting them from the local level up to the state, but the spending goes up. And what the politicians at the local level are reacting to is property taxes are a very visible tax that's difficult to increase. Sales taxes and income taxes are largely less visible, sales taxes in particular, and they're easy to raise a little bit here and there and generate a great deal of income. So, of course, the tax and spenders love the idea of shifting from a difficult tax to raise a transparent, visible, painful, difficult tax to raise, property taxes, and shift it over to a sales tax, much less visible. How much did you pay in sales taxes last year? Do you know? I could go find out how much I paid in federal and state income taxes. It's written down on my statement, right?
That's right.
There's nothing like that on sales. So,
And it's dink and dunk, pennies at a time. You know, it's hitting you every day, but it's these little transactions, you know, sometimes very large transactions, but little transactions, you just don't know.
Look, the tax and spenders are not stupid. They're evil. They know what they're doing. This is a deliberate effort to shift the tax burden from visible, difficult to raise taxes to less visible, easier to raise taxes, so that the local politicians go, hey, I didn't raise your taxes. And the state guys go, hey, we were helping keep your property taxes down. No, what keeps your property taxes down is voters voting the mayor out. That's what keeps property taxes down.
That's right. Yeah, so let's talk for listeners out there about this proposal that's going on in Texas. So we started out, there's a House Joint Resolution 3, which is a straight-up a tax increase. They have this proposal, let's increase the sales tax by a penny, so from the total all net 8.25 to 9.25, our state sales tax would go to being the highest state sales tax in the country. It'd be 7.25 with 2 cents of local taxes on top. So 9.25 sales tax, but then we're going to give 1/4 of the increased revenue just to the schools, more throwing money at the schools without reform, and then 75% of that to buying down property taxes. Well, you guys would say that's a straight up, easy to see it. That's a violation of the pledge that all these Republicans, you know, you guys enforce, where they say, hey, I'm not for raising taxes. Yeah, you are. This is a tax increase.
Yeah, somehow they get this idea that if you raise taxes and spend it, it's revenue neutral. No, it'd be deficit neutral, but it's a tax and spend.
Right.
And handing money to the local government is spending money. You made quite the correct point that on education spending, the one thing we know in the United States of America is spending more money on education without making reforms on hiring and firing and whether the money goes into the classroom or into bureaucracy. More money spent under the aegis of education has zero impact on how well kids learn.
Right.
We only have 50 years of experience of that happening. There are other factors that matter, but raising spending is not one of them. This is not a maybe. We know this. So it is wasted money unless you are deliberately doing something different, in which case, if you can more productively spend the money, you don't have to raise spending.
There's plenty of money there for education. We're just wasting it on literally, you know, stadiums and water parks and corrupt vendor deals and buildings people don't need. The seventh assistant principal who's going around making everybody's job more difficult, basically. All of that going around. But so this was the proposal. So this is a clear tax tax increase, tax and spend. Then you have, and this is really the more concerning part, is you have Governor Abbott, Lieutenant Governor Patrick, Speaker Bonin come out in this, you know, the big three, and they say, okay, no. We want it to be revenue neutral that we're going to raise the sales tax and buy down property taxes. But when I look at that, I say, show me the mechanism where you're effectively going to reduce property taxes, because, you know, that's the key. And so far, when we go back and look at what was done in 2006, whenever Governor Perry did the business margins tax increase, they've increased taxes at the state level, but that money has not effectively done anything to even stall or delay property tax growth.
Yeah, the legislature of Texas should go to New Jersey. They could learn something from New Jersey.
Okay. Well, our friend Charles Blaine would probably agree, but I'm skeptical about what we would learn from New Jersey. But go on.
Here is what you learned from New Jersey. In New Jersey in 1965, they had property taxes. They did not have a statewide sales tax. They did not have a statewide income tax, neither. In 1965, people said, these property taxes are killing us. We have to do something to get the property taxes down. So they passed a sales tax. And about 10 years later, 76, 77, the governor said, these property taxes are killing us. We've got to do something about these property taxes. So they put in an income tax. So they now, since 1965, I mean, this is not something that happened in, you know, the Depression or something. 1965, no sales tax, no income tax, and high property taxes. Now they have high property taxes, high sales taxes, and high income taxes. All of that money did not buy down property taxes. It got you bigger government at the local level and bigger government at the state level.
And is New Jersey a utopian paradise today?
I haven't been there recently. Well, you can probably talk to people in Texas, because New Jersey is one of those states that exports people.
Ah, okay. So they are moving
here.
They
believe it.
Okay, they are moving here. It's not a utopian.
And Florida. Because they see your income tax, your sales tax getting higher than Florida, so they're starting to move to Florida in preparation for high tax Texas sales tax. This is a challenge. There have been efforts to cap local taxes that have had some success. Prop 13 required a vote of the people locally to raise taxes. Florida has a measure where your entire tax burden, property tax, can only go up 3% a year, and it's capped there. There are various things that other states have. Yet, if you want to raise your rate above, I think it's 2.5 in Massachusetts that they put it in 80. You have to have a vote of the people in the local government.
Wait a second. So let me key in on that, because that's one of the proposals our legislature has been talking about is, okay, if a local government wants to increase the effective tax burden on existing structures, existing real estate, more than 2.5%, and then they keep floating it now, maybe 3.5%, and other people want higher numbers. But let's say 2.5% is what they started with. Then you'd have to go get a vote of the people. You're telling me that's been the law in Massachusetts for 40 years?
The rate is set at 2.5 there, okay? If you want to raise taxes, it requires a vote of the people.
Wow.
In Massachusetts. Massachusetts is not as crazy as you think. That's why it's still standing. They passed something, well, the legislature's crazy, but the people in the state passed a measure very similar to Proposition 13, which also got rid of mandatory arbitration, which is one way the unions just jack up prices and so on, and this is all done in Massachusetts. Hasn't been undone. It's a law. It is so popular, it is a law. It has not been undone. It's had almost the strength of a constitutional amendment. Now, here's the challenge of any lockbox. We bring in Al Gore for the voiceover. We're going to have a lockbox. We're going to raise the sales tax, and we're going to put it on a lockbox, and it can only be used to reduce your local property taxes from what? From an imaginary increase in the future? From today's numbers? You know, okay, so you got to decide what that is. And then the idea that you can have a lockbox with cash in it that local officials cannot, with enough time and energy, get into strikes me as counter-historical. We always love to read these stories about escape from coal debts or, where guys dig out of POW camps.
Sure.
Or the Count of Monte Cristo has a soup spoon and he digs through concrete and eventually escapes from the impenetrable prison that he's in. Prisoners have all the time in the world and only one thing to do, and that is figure out how to get out. Politicians have all the time in the world and one thing they really want to do, which is get in any money that's possible, raise taxes somehow. So if you design a foolproof system to stop them from raising taxes, they will eventually break it down. So it's just awfully difficult to know that you're doing that. I would recommend putting the efforts on requiring votes of the people, 2/3 votes of any local body to do something, making any tax increase temporary, it floods, something happens, there's a panic, people want to go, okay, this time we'll give you a tax increase. And a few years later they go, yeah, we don't need to keep that tax increase, but it's there.
Yeah, and I think what I'm hearing from you is, okay, if we're going to have if they want to propose some kind of tax swap, I mean, you got to be really skeptical when they say, oh, I want to increase this tax to lower this other tax. Maybe, okay, we're going to swap and we're going to eliminate, maybe abolish a tax and do something else. Maybe works. I'm trying to think of a scenario where you could trust that a tax swap is really, a revenue neutral or revenue reducing tax swap.
You could ban certain taxes, not simply abolish them, but ban them. It's much more difficult to put in a new tax. It is much easier to take a tax and raise it that exists than it is to create a new one. So if you are trading, much better to trade for the abolition of a tax than for the reduction in a particular tax. The other one is and people in Texas and in various cities can much better than anybody outside of Texas can come up with additional safeguards, additional padlocks. It's like Houdini, he kept putting padlocks on padlocks, and then he put them inside a plastic bag and big safe and all this stuff. If they balk at putting on an extra pair of handcuffs, they figured out how to take the first handcuffs off, and that's why they're not complaining.
This is a great analogy.
Because I've been through this in Colorado, where I worked with somebody who said he just wanted to make this one little thing change, but then he was never going to allow taxes to grow. And I said, well, then here are two things you could do that would stop it from running away and becoming a significant bigger tax increase. He balked at both of those, and at that point I knew he'd actually joined the other team and was not protecting taxpayers because he wanted to leave the back door open for the burglars.
Yep, that is a great piece of advice as we're watching these politicians handle this issue. They don't want additional locks and keys and safes and handcuffs, that means that they are ready to slip loose of what we already have. We're running out of time. Tell folks out there, how can they connect, learn more about the work you all do with Americans for Tax Reform?
Sure. Americans for Tax Reform asks all candidates to sign the Taxpayer Protection Pledge. Governors, state legislators, presidents, congressmen, senators, about 90% plus of Republicans in the House and Senate have taken the pledge, kept the pledge. We haven't had a Republican vote for a tax bill that passed since 1994 when most Republicans signed the pledge, and that's been our big protection ever since. Also, before 1994, in the 60 years before, the Republicans only held the House for 4 years. The Democrats only held the Senate for 10 of 60 years. Since everyone took the pledge and started keeping it after George Herbert Walker Bush broke his pledge, but when everybody took it and kept it, we have had more than 2/3 of the time in the House, more than 5/6 of the time, have held the House and the Senate. So taking the pledge, keeping the pledge, not raising taxes, re-elects Republican majorities.
Agreed.
Being available on taxes gives the Democrats all the running room they want in the world.
Yep. So ATR.org. So if folks want to check that out. Great work you guys do. Thank you for joining us, and appreciate it.
Thank you.
What are you doing Sunday evening? With the Texas legislative session back in full swing, we're spending our Sundays making sure you are staying informed with Sunday Scorecard, a product of Texas Scorecard TV. Catch the Texas Scorecard team and guests every Sunday at 7:30 p.m. live on the Empower Texans Facebook page to hear the latest news from Austin, D.C., or even your local city governments. That's Sunday Scorecard, live Sundays at 7:30 p.m. throughout the legislative session. You can find show archives and more information at texasscorecard.com. Join the conversation this Sunday evening.
In this week's commentary, Robert Montoya tells us why film subsidies aren't just bad for taxpayers, they're bad for filmmakers too.
Taking money from taxpayers to fund films isn't just harmful for the taxpayers, it's bad for filmmakers too. Hi, I'm Robert Montoya with this week's Texas Scorecard radio commentary. Recently, the Texas House voted on the state's new budget and decided to spend our tax dollars on the Texas Moving Image Incentive Program, which essentially takes our cash and gives it to filmmakers. As a taxpayer, I find this outrageous, but as a filmmaker, I find this harmful. See, we pay our taxes for core services of government, like public safety and education, but when government takes our money and spends it on things outside of that, like films, we have a right to be upset. That's our money we could be using to buy groceries, pay down debt, or invest in our children's education. But why do I think these handouts are also harmful to filmmakers? Well, first let me say that I love film. The art of using visuals, writing a script, and working with a variety of talented people to tell a story is both a stressful and beautiful craft. But it's not one that taxpayer dollars should go to. Government handouts encourage the wrong idea that more money solves everything. Texas filmmaking legend Robert Rodriguez referred to this line of thinking in his book, Rebel Without a Crew, as turning on the money hose. Instead of focusing on telling a strong story with limited resources, filmmakers are often tempted to cover story problems up with money like it's spackle. I've fallen into this trap before, which paralyzed me, and Hollywood has too, but in their case, they're making bigger and bigger-er films. This has legends like Steven Spielberg warning the film industry is headed for a major market reset. If that happens, then Austin is putting taxpayers at risk. But won't taxpayer-funded incentives help new filmmakers get started? Years ago, my filmmaking buddy and I failed to get a grant from Austin, and looking back, I think it was a good thing. Had I, as a young filmmaker, been given taxpayer funds to make a film, I highly doubt I would have known how to spend it wisely because I had no experience trying to tell a story with limited resources. But Rodriguez did, and learned from it. He started with nothing, then later made El Mariachi with just $7,000 he raised through hard work and sweat. This year, he just came out with Battle Angel Alita with a budget of $170 million. And he's not the only one to pull this off. Just see Christopher Nolan's first film, Following, which he shot on weekends for an entire year while working a full-time job. Today, he's one of Hollywood's most renowned filmmakers who's directed titles such as The Dark Knight and Inception. Those two directors didn't need handouts to get going. Taxpayer-funded handouts, like the Texas Film Program, rob filmmakers of the lesson of how to tell a good story while wisely spending every single penny you have or don't have. Film is an extremely tough business. If you want to do it, the pain of long hours, working a regular job while your passion consumes your free time, and getting no money in return will prepare you for the future. When you go through that process, you'll know in your heart if you really love filmmaking or just the glory of it. And as if to prove a point, Rodriguez just came out with a new film, Red 11, also made for just $7,000. We need to end taxpayer-funded film handouts. Film needs it, filmmakers need it, and most importantly, taxpayers need it, because it's their money. With this week's Texas Scorecard Radio Commentary, I'm Robert Montoya. Thank you for listening.
Well, that's all I've got for you, folks. If you're not subscribed already, go on and subscribe to the Texas Scorecard Radio podcast, available on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Spotify. Thanks for listening.
Texas Scorecard Radio is brought to you each week as a public service from the Empower Texans Foundation and in partnership with the Lincoln Institute and this station. You can download podcasts from each program and learn more at empowertexans.com.